Not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio.
Welcome to A View of World Affairs from Greenwich. Politics, economy, history. A careful examination of the world's interrelationships and how they affect us, here in our country as well as here in Greenwich. And now here is your host, Fotis Baliakas.
Good morning, Greenwich. Hope everybody's doing well. We have a great program set up today. This episode is not going to be just me. I'm sure you're getting tired of my voice talking about all the geopolitical issues. This is the first time we have invited a guest, a very accomplished geopolitical risk analyst. I will introduce John Sitilidis a little later, but he is going to give us a great perspective. He is a native New Yorker who is in Washington, D.C., so we're going to have a great program today. Just to let you know, on a regular basis, on Saturday from 0900 hours to 1000 hours, Saturday mornings, all the way to June, we're going to have programs that talk about international relations, security issues, geopolitics, geoeconomics. So Fotis Baliakas here. I just want to remind you again what Thucydides said 2,500 years ago, and that's what we're discussing here in many different ways. The strong do what they can, and the weak struggle as they must. And that is the case every time. So here in the United States, we're the, in my view, the hegemon of the world, and we have a lot of others who are challenging us, and they will continue to challenge us. And some of the struggles that we have now, and we will be talking about with John later on in the program, is the challenges that we are facing for the world order that we have established. So today, after I give you an introduction, John, we will talk about the biggest issue there is, the Ukrainian war, the involvement of us, Europe, Russia, China, the rest of the world. We will talk about China, a big issue in the economic sphere, in the military sphere, and in the international geopolitics. Then we'll talk about a little bit of energy. Energy is a big issue that affects the entire world, our economies. And we will talk about alliances and other geopolitical and economic issues. So without further ado, I would like to introduce John. John Sitilidis is a Washington, D.C. governmental affairs and geopolitical risk specialist who brings nearly four decades of political, business, and foreign policy experience to inform investors, corporate, government, and civil leadership audiences of U.S. and global risk trends, international threat assessments, and geopolitical strategies. He launched and directed two respected international relations institutes in Washington, D.C., including at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Under a U.S. government contract since 2006, John is the Southern Europe Regional Coordinator at the Foreign Service Institute, the State Department's Professional Development and Diplomacy Academy for American Foreign Policy Professionals. He launched his career in the United States Senate, has testified before Congress, and is a frequent national security commentator on Bloomberg News and other leading U.S. and international media. A native New Yorker from Astoria, Queens, for those who you are wondering where he is from, John holds a master's degree in international affairs from Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. So John and I have quite a few things in common, other than being, you know, two strong-minded Greeks with a lot of knowledge and education in the subject. He is obviously very accomplished, and we will be talking about the subjects of the current issues from the perspective that John is very native now to Washington, D.C. So he reads the pulse, he has the fingers on the pulse in Washington, and he can give us an understanding from there. So, John, welcome. Good morning. Hope you're doing well in the D.C. area. What occupies your mind? What are your clients so that they're in the international business, supply chain, finance? What are they thinking about? What you're telling them, what do they worry about?
Well, first of all, Fotis, thank you very much for having me on your program this morning, and great to connect with you and to be able to share some of my insights with your, as you mentioned before, your very well-informed and distinguished audience. Let me also emphasize, and thank you very much for going through the very generous introduction there, that one of the best parts about this is, yes, I'm a native New Yorker in Washington, D.C., but it's always great to connect to my New York friends. And I once made the mistake when I first moved to California in the 1990s, I described myself as a former New Yorker. And my New Yorker friend said, you will never describe yourself as a former New Yorker. There's no such thing. You're a native New Yorker forever. So it's on that basis that it's great to talk to your New York audience and those who are listening and online around the world. And yes, it is a kaleidoscopic picture from here in Washington, D.C., the multitude of issues, regional, functional, global, geoeconomic, that we're looking to manage on a daily basis. And if I might, Fotis, you know, maybe the way we structure this, obviously, most people day to day watching the news are consumed by Russia's invasion of Ukraine, America's support for defending Ukraine, and the G7 sanctions against Russia. And maybe it's right that we talk about that to satisfy that interest. But I will posit that the largest strategic issue for the United States, both as a nation state, the most powerful country that mankind has ever known, but also the wealthiest economy that mankind has ever known, and looking ahead into the decades of the 21st century, is going to be the strategic rivalry between democratic, small d, free market, capitalist America versus the Communist Party of China. And that will play out in a number of permutations. And what I'd like to do is break it down over what, for lack of a sort of a better phrase, the three T's, Taiwan, technology, and trade. And after we talk about Russia, Ukraine, China, and the three T's, if we have an opportunity to talk about, you know, the so-called energy revolution and the lessons learned from Europe's response to the invasion of Ukraine, I think that'll be a very enriching part of this conversation as well.
Great. That is a great quick summary of the ongoings. Absolutely, the war in Ukraine, obviously, it involves not only the United States, but the entire world right now. You know, 140 countries voted in the UN to condemn, and a lot of them, 37 of them actually, didn't vote or vote against it, that. So where are we now? How is our political situation, the domestic political situation in the U.S., affect the war and its implications to win it? And what do you think is our perception of win? And is it different than the Europeans?
I don't think anyone in Washington, D.C. has a credible scenario for winning this war. If you listen to the president and to Democrats and Republicans who support the policies of the last year, the idea is that the United States will support Ukraine, quote, as long as it takes. But they haven't defined what it is. And I don't know many people who honestly believe that Ukraine can defeat Russia in a war. Russia is a nuclear superpower. It has more nuclear weapons than the United States. And part of its strategic doctrine, way before the invasion of Ukraine, going back decades, even after the collapse of the Soviet Union, Fotis, was the use of tactical nuclear weapons in order to escalate, to de-escalate. And that is that Russian military doctrine doesn't hold nuclear weapons as some type of taboo, the way we have in the United States and certainly our European allies have. They see it as the normal course of a military escalation ladder. And if they feel that they're being backed into the corner or there is some major crisis about to take place, for instance, major NATO-supported Ukrainian attacks against Crimea, or the possible overthrow of the Putin regime, There's no reason to believe that that possible escalation won't be part of the military planning. And I'm not saying it's going to take place, but we can't seriously talk about escalating the war between Russia and Ukraine without considering the possibility that Russia will detonate a nuclear weapon, maybe over a barren part of the Ukrainian battlefield, maybe over the Black Sea, but not to attack or destroy any inch of NATO, which President Biden has sworn to defend. But I think more importantly, to sow shock the West into forcing Zelensky's hand to come to the table and to negotiate a ceasefire, an armistice, an end to the war. Of course, more on Putin's terms than on Zelensky's terms. But I think, A, we need to be mindful of that nuclear arsenal in the context of talking about Ukrainian ludicrously winning a war against Russia. It's simply not going to happen. It's also not going to happen because, as you correctly noted, Fotis, 140 or so countries voted to condemn the invasion. But I'm frankly not surprised that any national leader at the time of the invasion voted in the UN to condemn the invasion. I'm actually surprised by the three dozen or so that you cite that either abstained or voted to not condemn, because every national leader, I would presume, has an interest in condemning any invasion of another country in order to protect their own sovereign rights against a possible invasion by a neighboring country, unless those three dozen or so feel completely safe surrounded by non-threatening countries. So I think if I would take a deeper dive, Fotis, I would say that what's a more important metric is how many countries are participating in the sanctions regime. And that's a very small number. I mean, the president and the EU leaders talk about the international sanctions regime. There's no such thing. It's a G7, largely Western sanctions regime. The U.S., our European allies, obviously the G7, but then the larger European Union. And of course, in the Pacific, it's Japan, South Korea, conditionally, Australia and New Zealand. That's pretty much it. Most of what we call the Global South has utterly sat out this international sanctions regime. And we're talking about not just China, obviously, but major powers such as India, Brazil, South Africa, Nigeria, Turkey, a NATO ally, have all sat out the sanctions regime. And that's because they don't feel particularly threatened by what they see as an intra-European war, or if you take it down to the granular level, an intra-Slavic war between Slavic brothers, the Orthodox Russian Slavs and the largely Orthodox with a minority of Catholic Slav Ukrainians. And so those countries are still very dependent on Russia for oil, coal, natural gas, timber, diamonds, and other natural resources, critical metals, rare earth elements, and of course, very importantly, foodstuffs and fertilizers to feed their societies. And they're not going to risk those trade relations with a commodity superpower, that is the Russian Federation, in order to satisfy the U.S. or Brussels or certain European Union countries that are most alarmed, and honestly so, credibly so, Poland, the Baltic countries, Romania, that are just west of Russia and Belarus and Ukraine, that should be very seriously concerned about their own security. But other countries are going to pursue their national interests. So you have a nuclear superpower and a commodity superpower in Russia. And so I think you have less of an international sanctions regime than most Americans have been led to believe by a media that really hasn't done a very good job of explaining what is happening in that part of the world. So I would say that's the larger backdrop. In terms of U.S. aid, Fotis, the Biden administration has been gradually increasing its support. Remember in February and March of last year, right after the invasion, Joe Biden himself said, we're not going to be providing any type of offensive weaponry or defensive weaponry that can strike into Russia. We're going to be very careful and very measured and largely rely on financial sanctions. And we saw the weaponization of the dollar against Russia kicking in right away along with those of our EU partners. But what's happened since then is a gradual escalation of the armament of the Ukraine armed forces versus Russia. And now they have tanks, or they'll be getting tanks. And we don't know if they'll be getting tanks realistically, anything useful for another 6 months. I mean, my fear for the Ukrainian people who deserve the right to defend their country against the Russian invasion are being sold a political bill of goods to placate Western audiences. But many of the European tanks with any significant military use and import aren't arriving in Ukraine for another 4 to 6 months. And the U.S., to the degree that we're actually going to be sending Abrams tanks, we're going to be refitting them. They're not getting our best Abrams tanks that we're using right now because we're afraid that if one of those gets into Russian hands, the Russians will, reverse engineer those tanks and then take the most advanced technology and apply it to their tank technology. So we're going to give the Ukrainians a lesser version of our Abrams tanks, which are going to be built starting today, which means they're going to be delivered in about 12 months. And I don't know what use they'll be to Ukraine in 12 months unless the war is continuing then and the Ukrainian economy continues to be crippled. It's already lost 30% of GDP. 8 to 11 million Ukrainians are outside the country right now, and we hope they'll be able to return and want to return to participate in the reconstruction of Ukraine. But my larger fear, Fotis, and I'll close on this, I want to make sure that we have time for a number of other topics here, is that it's a very well-intentioned policy out of Washington to support Ukraine. I'm a little bit skittish about quote-unquote democracy versus autocracy because, as we'll discuss in this geopolitical context of the next 35, 40 minutes, we do need a number of autocratic countries who happen to be allies and partners of ours. They don't adhere to our Western concepts of human rights and individual freedom and the like, but they occupy very important geographic parts of the world, and better to have them as allies and as partners and as enemies. So this is not really a clean-cut war in favor of democracy over autocracy. So I think we need to be careful about that rhetoric. But more importantly, I think we need to think seriously about what an end game looks like and how do we persuade the parties in Russia and in Ukraine to also think about a realistic end game for them and then see if there's a way to even bring about a ceasefire in the immediate future and see if the parties can negotiate. Because the longer this war goes on, the more deeply and profoundly the Russian and Ukrainian people will despise and hate and loathe each other. And it'll make it that much more difficult to achieve any type of a diplomatic agreement. And that is not in the interest of Europe. It's not in the interest of our neighbors to the south that depend on Russia and Ukraine for foodstuffs and fertilizers and very important commodities. And it's not good for the Ukrainian people who have suffered the most, nor is it good for the Russian people who largely live in an autocratic regime whose media is controlled by Vladimir Putin. And I would posit are probably ill-informed about what this has done to Russia's reputation around the world. So a number of concerns that I have. And one last thing, Fotis, I'll squeeze this in. I think that there is going to be a very interesting coalition emerging in the U.S. Congress between what I would call the non-interventionist Republicans who feel that $100 billion to Ukraine has been very generous on the part of the U.S., but we really can't afford $100 billion a year in perpetuity for, quote unquote, as long as it takes, while we're dealing with massive deficits here in the United States and a growing national debt. And keep in mind, with rising interest rates that your audience knows very much about, right now, until 2022, 2023, the U.S. has been paying about $300 to $350 billion in federal debt service. But with interest rates at 4% and 5% and possibly 6%, by 2030, the U.S. government will be paying $900 billion to $1 trillion a year in debt service alone. And that's going to squeeze out money that's needed for military defense of our nation, for Social Security, and for Medicare. So we're going to have some very serious problems down the road. Now, $100 billion for Ukraine a year isn't going to necessarily tilt the balance completely, but for Republicans and Democrats to start to work together towards some type of fiscal balance in Washington, we are going to have to address this issue. And I would add, they'll be joined, not so much for fiscal responsibility purposes, but more from an ideological perspective, by the traditionally anti-war left, the code pink types, the ones who were opposed to the Afghanistan war 2 or 3 months after the 9/11 attacks. And they surfaced briefly back in October of 2022. with a letter calling on President Biden to bring the parties to the table. They were shot down in one day by the White House and by then Speaker Pelosi to make very clear to the American people and to the Ukrainian government that the White House is directing Democratic Party control over foreign policy, not the Squad and those sort of more anti-war left. But we'll see what happens with the non-interventionist Republicans and anti-war left possibly coming together to form a very intriguing coalition to try to bring about a reconsideration of how deeply America will become involved in this now 14-month-old war between Russia and Ukraine.
Wow, John, what great insights. That's I'm astonished with that depth of knowledge and the insight, because the coalition that we have, I thought that the financial stronghold that we have put around Russia with the cap on the $60 for the oil, the barrel, and now not allowing for their distillates to be sold in Europe, it will somehow curtail their ability to maintain war. But no, I remember clearly Erdogan saying that we're not for the sanctions because they're not covered by the UN, and they are unilateral from the U.S. And that, obviously, Saudi Arabia and everybody else will do that.
That's also the Chinese government's position.
And the Chinese government.
Yes. Beijing says that the U.S.-led sanctions regime has no basis in international law. And let me just add a couple of color points here to what you just noted. Yes, we've all been led to believe that there is this sort of superior energy sanctions cutoff between Europe and Russia and the like. A couple of data points that I think are very instructive for your audience, Fotis. And we'll maybe one day find out who actually blew up the Nord Stream pipelines in September of last year. But there are still two pipelines from Russia across Ukraine that are providing pipeline gas to the European Union to this day. One goes into Slovakia, which also feeds the energy markets in Hungary. And the other one goes across the Black Sea into Turkey, which feeds Southeast European markets. And to the degree that any pipeline still traverses Ukrainian territory, the Ukrainian government is generating transit fees from allowing Russian companies to ship, to supply Russian gas through pipelines crossing Ukrainian territory into the EU. So Ukraine is benefiting from that still, you know, smaller amount of Russian gas being piped in. Secondly, the European Union purchased more liquefied natural gas from Russia in 2022 than it did in 2021 and 2020. So LNG purchases by the European Union actually increased about 10 to 12% last year while the sanctions regime was in place. And lastly, the United States, because we've done so much damage to our own uranium mining capacity here in the United States because of very, what I would call, onerous and unrealistic environmental regulations, we're dependent on world supplies of uranium to power our nuclear facilities, including about 10 to 12% of our annual uranium imports from Russia. And so the Biden administration made sure we did not sanction those uranium exports. So this is kind of a Swiss cheese energy sanctions regime that we've imposed on Russia. They're piping gas to the European Union, selling more LNG than in the last 3 or 4 years, and still selling uranium to the United States.
Wow, that is so interesting and so contradicting to all the general information that we get. So right. Just staying with that subject for a minute before we switch over to China, the European coalition, I see Germany as the biggest of all, but there are conflicts there. I mean, Germany is dependent on the U.S. nuclear umbrella for security. Mm-hmm. It depends on Russia, or not as much now, for its energy to fuel its industry and export business. And it depends on trade with China. So right. How do they disengage from that and they become free? I know Scholz came over to the White House and they spoke. I just don't see them being very decisive. They said some things that they will help and they will change. They did change the LNG that took the two pipelines out. By the way, they found out most recently that there was a sailboat with six people on board that had something to do with the pipeline explosion over the Black Sea. So how does Germany get out of that stronger? I just don't see them being so decisive. That changeover is not happening fast enough, or is not happening at all.
Well, I think the operative word in your question is stronger. I don't know that Germany comes out of this stronger. In fact, some might argue that Germany is, whether it is willing to or not, already embarking on a process of deindustrialization. If you look at what's happened over the last year because of the tremendous spike in energy pricing for Germany and for Europe, because of self-imposed energy sanctions they've tried to impose on Russia, which are hurting Europe more than they're hurting Russia, frankly. Energy prices for, say, steel-making companies, ceramics-making companies, glass-making companies, chemical processors have nearly quadrupled in Germany over the last 12 months. And so a number of these major corporations are leaving Germany. Now, they'll be looking for other areas in Europe. Some may be looking for facilities in the United States, ironically. And some, unfortunately, may move or open up new facilities in the People's Republic of China, ruled by the Communist Party of China.
Alert from no backups
so,
for 10 days.
I don't know that Germany's sort of economy is going to come out stronger anytime in the near future. And by making themselves energy dependent, first on fossil fuels, Fotis, right, on Russia, an autocratic hostile regime that threatens the security of Europe. So who are the geniuses in Berlin who said, well, let's make the German economy more dependent on Russia? And now Germany is learning in a very difficult way what it means to have that authoritarian hostile power cut off energy supplies or to cut them off yourself because you are working with the U.S. to try to punish Russia for invading Ukraine. At the same time, the German people have unrealistically voted to shut down their six nuclear facilities. Luckily, three of them were still online when the sanctions regime kicked in last year, and the German government has held on. They closed three last year, held on to the last three. But Germany now has increased its use of coal, of carbon-emitting coal, in their quest to achieve 2035 and 2050 net zero carbon emissions. They've shut down their nuclear facilities, which are zero carbon and the most energy-dense form of production in the world, known today at least. And now they're increasing their use of coal, all to provide for some type of energy, reliable energy basis for their industry, which is still dependent, A, on exports to China, while China is stealing German technology to build up jewel companies inside of China to then overtake Germany in the advanced industrial sector of the global economy. And also, as Germany and other countries move towards this sort of ideological goal of achieving major energy production via renewables, such as solar panels and wind turbines, that processing, that production is still largely dominated in terms of global supply chains by the Communist Party of China. Not just that, not only are they dominant in terms of production of wind turbines and solar panels, but they also control most of the processing and refining of rare earth elements that are required to build those solar panels and wind turbines. So until Germany and the broader European Union bloc are able to actually build a domestic continent-wide renewable energy infrastructure, they will become dependent on renewable energy to power their advanced industrial economies on a hostile authoritarian China, having not quite learned the lesson of being dependent for hydrocarbons on a hostile authoritarian Moscow.
Wow. That is a dilemma that 16 years of Merkel's reign, it went the other way. And now they're trying to undo it in the next couple of years. That will be a challenge.
And what's interesting, Fotis, is I was speaking with an EU ambassador here in Washington several weeks ago who was lamenting the fact that, you know, first grateful that the U.S. is providing LNG supplies to make up for the cutoff in pipeline gas to the European Union. But in order to do that, the LNG was bought on the spot markets, not on long-term contracts. And so Asian countries and countries in the global south that thought they were getting U.S. LNG had those contracts overridden by new contracts with EU markets, but the EU had to pay probably about quadruple the cost in order to get the US LNG suppliers to get that LNG to European purchasers. And by the way, it's not the Americans that are gaining the profit from this quadrupling of the price. It's the European purchasers who are then distributing that American supplied LNG to European markets that are making most of that profit. But they're blaming the US for the quadrupling of the pricing when it's the EU that's left itself in this highly vulnerable position of having to quickly find LNG or any type of natural gas supplies, having done this damage through their own misguided policies of the last 15 years or so.
Very good point. Now, the last one here is NATO. Obviously, the same countries that we're talking about economically are in the 30 countries now that are in the NATO. Have they learned a lesson? Is this something that it was a wake-up call? They were all surprised about the violence of war, displacement of people, the catastrophe of the cities. They were pulverized. Why were they surprised by a war? It happened before. Now, how does NATO get together, and do they all contribute equally, like our prior president and Obama? Two presidents ago, they were saying, you need to contribute more. You need to offer more. You need to stand up for yourselves more. Is that going to happen, or this is following Germany again, which is wishy-washy on that issue?
Sadly, Fotis, I believe the answer is no. NATO is not going to cohere in any sort of realistic, credible, material way in the near future. And that's because many segments of what we would call the European Union or European society have become utopian. They're ideologically wedded to pacifism, and they're ahistorical, frankly. I mean, the history of mankind has largely been marked by war between kingdoms, between civilizations, between nation states. And what the US-led international trading system since the end of World War II has given the world is really almost 80 years without a third world war. And that's the basis for this international trading system, to prevent the catastrophes that destroyed Europe and parts of Asia in World War I and then especially in World War II. And so it's been a largely successful program of the last 80 years. And we'll talk now shortly about why China is looking to upend that order of the last 80 years. But I think the problem has been that we've allowed Europeans, especially with really the end of the Cold War, because Europe was directly threatened by the Soviet Union, which had heavily armed all of the Eastern and Central European countries and were poised for a conventional attack against Western Europe from the end of World War II until 1989. But after the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact and then the Soviet Union in 1991, the Europeans felt that they had achieved this period of a Kantian, Immanuel Kant, the great philosopher, of perpetual peace, that somehow Europe had found the magic kingdom and that they were going to provide the model for the rest of the world so that as long as everyone is in a trading bloc and open borders and freedom of movement and of capital and of labor and the like, that there was no reason to be concerned about war anymore. And I think the Europeans missed the fact that Vladimir Putin began openly pronouncing this in 2007 and 2008, that NATO encroaching on Russia was going to cross a red line. Yeah. And when Georgia was invaded, the Republic of Georgia in 2008, and no one in Europe did a thing about it, that sent a signal to Russia that Putin's got breathing room for military invasions of neighboring countries. And in 2014, when Russia annexed Crimea, and the European Union had some minor sanctions, as did the U.S., Russia sent the unmarked military forces into eastern Ukraine to help the separatists there. Again, no response. But there was military activity happening all around Europe's periphery in the Caucasus and in Central Europe since 2008. So there should have been no surprise here at all. And now that they are surprised, we see divisions that are really manifesting themselves inside of NATO, where you have, as I mentioned earlier, Fotis, countries such as Poland, which wants a permanent U.S. military presence, and probably some of the Baltic countries would also. Sweden, they want a more muscular NATO to deal with what they see as an outsized Russian threat. You have Sweden and Norway, I mean Finland, now wanting to come into the NATO alliance, which would effectively double NATO's border with Russia. But then you have more sanguine countries like Spain that don't feel very threatened by Russia, by Italy, by Greece. And then you have those countries such as Germany, which are concerned about their security, but have historically close economic and diplomatic ties with Russia, that I think would like to find a way to bring this war to an end and down the road to be able to rebuild those energy and economic and trade ties with Russia. So there is no unity whatsoever in NATO, except where Washington comes in. Uncle Sam really is NATO for all intents and purposes. And if you just look at the dollars, Fotis, the U.S. has provided more military, financial, and humanitarian aid to the people and government of Ukraine more than twice than the entire European Union combined. So this is the kind of scale of influence and of power projection that the U.S. brings. Without the U.S., there's no NATO. And Europe has largely left itself constitutionally incapable of defending its borders against an external threat. And the only reason that Europe has been able to prosper, especially as the European Union for the last 30 years, is by essentially, I mean, to use Obama's phrase, free riding on the NATO security umbrella. But I think a number of weaknesses have been shown here. And I don't really see, except again, is it for a handful of countries that directly border either Russia, Belarus, or Ukraine, I don't see a very serious commitment to the future of an independent, quote unquote, strategically autonomous Europe, as Macron would posit, except maybe for France and the United Kingdom, to be fair, joining those Eastern European countries. But most of Western Europe would like to get back to business as usual as quickly as possible, I believe.
Wow. Very good summary. Very good summary there. Let's switch to the big white elephant or dragon in the room.
The big red elephant.
The red elephant, yes. So China.
Yes.
Yeah, Thucydides and the trap we were talking about, the up-and-coming power versus the incumbent. Obviously, we're competing in economic terms, political terms, our system, and hopefully not soon in military terms. But yes, there's an arms race of some sorts. Taiwan is the epicenter of all of these activities. How would you summarize our current relationship? And then we'll pick on what can happen next vis-a-vis Taiwan and any other hot points that we'll find other than the balloons that they were incidental. What else can lead us to a more pronounced schism of our divisions in our relationship?
Right. Well, let me offer this, Fotis, if I might first, just a quick snapshot of historical background here, because I think we tend to look at the Communist Party of China in very ahistorical terms. But China itself today is the inheritor of a grand civilization that dates back 4,000 years. Just the way when we talk about Russia, you know, we talk about Russia largely as an outcast of its communist shell of the 20th century. But Russia is a great civilization that dates back 1,100 years. So we're dealing with civilizational powers here. And really until about the 1840s, 1850s, China was probably the world's largest economy for the better part of two millennia. And so any Chinese leader is going to seek to restore China to what the Chinese people and the Chinese leadership consider to be China's rightful place among the top economic powers in the world. That was always going to happen. Okay, so let's take that under consideration. But the U.S., looking back in the last 30 years, really committed one of the most strategic blunders, colossally, you know, error-ridden policies of any great power in modern history by facilitating and accelerating the economic and thereby military growth of what would eventually be its number one competitor or rival by actively seeking to bring China, before it was fully compliant, into the World Trade Organization in 2001. And if you just look at the data points on any good graph, you'll see that that's really where the Chinese economy took off. It was growing in the 1980s and the 1990s with the opening up and reforms instituted by Deng Xiaoping after the death of Mao Zedong in 1976. But it really took off. I mean, this meteoric growth that we talk about in modern day China began after the U.S. led the global effort to bring China into the World Trade Organization, whose rules and guidelines it's essentially violated repeatedly for the last 20 plus years with relative impunity. No one has found a way to punish China for these violations of WTO rules and guidelines. So we have that as a little bit of essential background here. But I think going forward, we have really under the rise of Xi Jinping to power in 2012 as General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, the beginning of this more intensive rivalry between the United States and China. And I put this mostly on Xi Jinping's shoulders, Fotis, for a couple of very basic reasons. For decades, you had a relatively smooth transition of power after two consecutive five-year terms by the prior general secretaries and presidents of China, until Xi Jinping, who just, of course, secured his norm-breaking third consecutive term, first as General Secretary of the Communist Party, which is really more important than what happened this past week. I mean, this is more like a nominal position of president. The Communist Party runs China, not the government of China. The Communist Party runs the government of China. The Communist Party runs the military of China, and the Communist Party runs the economy of China. And you cannot honestly and accurately discuss anything with China unless you admit that you're dealing with the Communist Party of China hidden behind this facade of a normally functioning government. It's not. It's not the way it is in any other nation state. But if one recalls, so Deng Xiaoping and other leaders talked about China's peaceful rise and biding its time and hiding its strength. And Xi Jinping came to power and took China on a very different course, a much more muscular, aggressive, ambitious course with the Belt Road Initiative,
the
right?
Wolf Warriors.
And using debt diplomacy, right, to indebt dozens of countries around the world to Chinese banks, state-owned enterprises and institutions under onerous and often corruptly achieved agreements. And when the repayment terms were too difficult for these governments to pay, then the Chinese government would move in and say, well, let's talk about possibly your handover of sovereign assets. Or if that becomes too embarrassing for China on the global stage, let's make sure that you vote for or not against China at the United Nations and in dozens of international organizations whose norms China is violating. So that's really what's happened with many of these countries in BRI. And then look at the South China Sea. This is an international waterway, maybe among the world's most important, and about a third of the world's commerce traverses the South China Sea, connecting the maritime superhighway of the Indian Ocean so that you have oil and natural gas coming in from the Middle East, natural resources and critical metals coming in from Africa, and access to European markets all through the Indian Ocean maritime superhighway that then goes into the South China Sea and provides for economic transactions with the People's Republic of China, with Taiwan, with Japan, with South Korea. And yet China has declared this entire massive waterway essentially a Chinese lake, ignoring and overriding the sovereign claims of at least seven Asian countries that have rightful claims: Vietnam, Indonesia, Brunei, Philippines, I think Malaysia as well, and Taiwan, although we can talk about whether Taiwan is an independent country or not. And when Xi Jinping started to dredge and reclaim geographic features like coals and reefs and shoals hundreds of miles off the Chinese coast in international waters, and President Obama in 2015 asked then Xi, General Secretary Xi, to desist from this, Xi assured him, please, Mr. President, these are just maritime safety features that we're building there. It's just to protect the Chinese merchant marine and fisheries and the like. And of course, now 8 years later, we see that he utterly lied, Xi Jinping, to President Obama. And now you have not just defensive military systems, but offensive military systems, anti-aircraft systems, anti-missile systems, cargo plane airports, to be able to move heavy equipment onto these seven outposts now of the Chinese military throughout the South China Sea, which threatens free and open shipping lanes that are vital for Japan's economy, South Korea, and Taiwan. And I think Taiwan, as you mentioned correctly, is really the linchpin issue here, Fotis. And let me just lay out three reasons why I think. One, of course, is that Taiwan is the advanced semiconductor superpower of the world. And China and the United States and Japan and the Netherlands are all very much involved in global semiconductor value chains. But the most advanced semiconductors today that are essential for artificial intelligence, the Internet of Things, robotics, military hardware of the most advanced levels are coming from 5, 4, 3, and possibly 2 nanometer semiconductors, the tiny beyond the imagination. And only Taiwan has perfected this technology to date, although you may see South Korea's Samsung moving into the mix. China is unable to match that superior level of semiconductor manufacturing. But if China is able to absorb Taiwan, ideally peacefully through capitulation, or if necessary, as Xi Jinping has openly stated in speeches that we can all read in open source intelligence domains, by force before 2049, they may seek to do so. And whoever controls Taiwan's semiconductor industry will likely control the global economy of the 21st century, which is why it's in America's interest that Taiwan be a free market, democratic entity, free from communist control from Beijing. And that's why its defense is so important for the U.S. economy and for the global economy. I will add that if China is able to control Taiwan, Taiwan is the middle link between what we call the first island of chains, Japan to the north, the Philippines and Indonesia to the south, that constrain China's military and prevent it from breaking out and projecting power deep into the Pacific Ocean to threaten Guam, to threaten Hawaii, to move into the Indian Ocean, and really give China a world-class naval and Air Force power projection capability that will upend the ability of the U.S. and other countries and other parts of the world to provide for the free and open shipping lanes that give us this unequaled prosperity that we know today in 2023, where it's the greatest time ever to be a human being alive on Earth, thanks to, materially, that is, thanks to this free and open trading system that the U.S. leads and protects. And I'll close on this on Taiwan, Fotis. It's also ideological. Americans tend to not be ideological about foreign policy. We're highly ideological, as we've come to realize in our polarized society, over domestic issues, but not so much on foreign policy. But for the Chinese Communist Party, and again, I reiterate, I come back to the Communist Party as distinct from the 1.3 billion Chinese people, a very hardworking, industrious people who deserve freedom and have been denied it by the Communist Party since 1949. But for the Communist Party, they have been trying to propagate to the Chinese people that given the sheer size and complexity and historical antecedents of the Chinese nation state today, only the Chinese Communist Party is capable of legitimately running the government, the society, the military, the economy, and the like. And yet, in Taiwan, you have a historically ethnic Han population from China, 23, 24 million people. Yes, they lived under an authoritarian regime until the 1980s. But for 30, almost 40 years, it's been a free market democratic system. Now, maybe the 20th largest economy in the world, incredibly prosperous, incredibly dynamic, incredibly vibrant. And it poses an ideological threat to the legitimacy of the Communist Party in China, because they're showing that the Chinese people don't need communists to run their society or their government. Taiwan threatens that grip that the Chinese Communist Party seeks to have over its people. And therefore, Taiwan's free market democratic system must eventually be smothered. And Taiwan has to become like Hong Kong. And we saw what happened to Hong Kong, the freedoms being denied there, and a sense of despair and despondency over this once vibrant free market democratic city. And the future of Taiwan bodes ill if we're not able to defend it against these types of Chinese designs.
Great points. John, I have my strong views on the sustainability of China to maintain its growth economic that gives it the ability, and the Communist Party, the ability to maintain its military growth and technological advances, et cetera. Demographically, obviously, they're declining. They're getting mm-hmm. older.
Yes.
For years, we've been listening to experts saying that in 2025, they will be the largest economy. They will surpass us in many different ways. What is your view of that growth right now, post-pandemic, which mm-hmm. now the community is coming, or the Energy Department actually came in and said that it came out of the lab. What's their trajectory? Is that are they continuing, or this is just a flash in the pan that will just come down to a 2%, 3% as opposed to 6% and 8% they did before in GDP growth?
I think most serious economists and analysts of the Chinese economy have forecast that the days of 10, 12, 15% growth that we saw in the 1990s and in the noughts is over. Right? That's pretty clear. And China's economy in many ways is normalizing, and that's to be expected. It can't sustain double-digit growths in perpetuity. And so looking out towards 2030, 2040, 2050, based on the demographics that you rightly point out, Fotis, that China's economy will largely grow at 4%, 3%, 2% in the future. You rightly note the catastrophic events of the very misguided one-child policy. You have the aging of China's society without the kind of social safety net that we have in the Western world. And you're not going to have children providing for their parents and grandparents in the future in an increasingly aging society. But right now, you also have very near-term problems, Fotis. You have 20% of China's college-educated growth that are unemployed. You have a significant slowdown in productivity growth per capita in China. And you also have this massive real estate bubble. And the question always seems to be, when, not if, is this real estate bubble going to collapse? And you also have the desire now of a number of industries around the world to rethink their dependence on Chinese supply chains, which were very useful and very cost efficient when you had just-in-time inventory before the COVID pandemic. But now that we've seen the kind of disruption that this foolish zero COVID policy under Xi Jinping that's done great damage to the Chinese economy, but also scared away a number of industries around the world from dependence on China, they'll be looking to reshore, not necessarily to the United States or to other Western advanced industrial economies, but possibly to Indonesia, to Vietnam, to India. I think from an American perspective, we would be smart to try to reshore in Central America or Latin America and help our southern neighbors build up their economies to also deal with our illegal immigration problem strategically. But I think that China is going to be on a slower growth trajectory. It will continue to grow most likely, and I'm not a forecaster, nor do I pretend to be one. But I don't know that it's ever going to overtake the U.S. economy, just the way we thought the Japanese were going to overtake us in the 80s exactly. and early 90s. Right. I'm old enough to remember,
yeah.
Fotis.
So am I. Yes. This.
But it really depends on the U.S. ability to retain our advantages. And right now, I don't know if our domestic divisions are going to stymie our ability to maintain our global lead as we have over the last 80 years.
John, thank you very much. What a great subject that we touched upon, the Ukrainian war in Europe and also Asia and China. We will definitely have you again. Your wealth of knowledge, your well-spoken, good-looking Greek. This is great, great material that you gave us, and a lot of food for thought. Thank you very much, and hope to see you again. Here you
Thank
have
you
it,
so
audience.
Thank you so much for having me, Fotis.
Our pleasure. Audience in Greenwich, New York, everywhere, thank you very much for listening to us, and we will get together with you next Saturday.
This
Be well.
Is your community radio station, serving Lower Fairfield County and Westchester.
USA News, I'm Jeremy Scott. Heavy rain in Central California has caused two deaths due to flooding. The state's Director of Emergency Services said over 9,000 people have been evacuated. Officials in Santa Cruz County say a town of 10,000 has been isolated by flooded roads. The heavy rain is melting mountain snow and turning streams into raging rivers. The National Weather Service is warning of flash flooding along the central coast to the Sierra Nevada foothills. The mountain range is nearing an all-time snow record, and forecasters predict much more over the coming days. A swarm of earthquakes in Alaska could signal a volcanic eruption.
There have been dozens of small earthquakes since Tuesday near the Tanaga volcano, which has been dormant for more than 100 years. The Alaska Volcano Observatory has now raised the alert level to orange, second highest level, with a volcano watch now in effect, both upgraded from yellow and advisory earlier in the week. Tanaga Island, with three connected volcanoes, last saw an eruption in 1914. I'm Ryan Daniels.
A Mexican drug cartel says its members